It is time for our talk with weekly talk with our good friends from the Berkshire Edge. It's theberkshireedge.com. And right here on the radio, it's Berkshire Edge live on air. We have Marcy and David. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right, we're all together here.
We've got a publisher and an editor.
That's right.
What more could one want?
What more could one want? A graphic designer.
That's right. All right, well, why don't we start off here, because we start off with a Connecticut firm purchasing the Barrington Plaza Shopping Center.
Yeah, no, this may not seem like a big story right now, although it's interesting to us. You know, we have this one big shopping center in Great Barrington, which was anchored by the Kmart. And the Kmart went out of business, they didn't go out of business, they closed that store, and Marshall's moved into part of their space. Now it seems that the whole shopping center has been sold to another firm. And the reason that this is interesting, at least to me, is that, you know, with the loss of Kmart and with the loss of a couple of stores downtown, the shopping for Great Barrington locals has been greatly diminished. I mean, the range of what's available in town is greatly diminished. And, you know, for many of the sort of household items and lower price items, you know, we have to go to Pittsfield now, which is a half hour away. So what's interesting to me about this story is the fact that, you know, there's life in this shopping center, and somebody has bought enough of it to invest in it. And hopefully the empty stores that are there will be revitalized under new management. And, you know, we won't have to travel so far to buy. I mean, you know, this is, for those of us who don't want to buy everything online, it's nice to have local opportunities.
What's interesting about this story is it parallels a story in the Hudson mm-hmm. Valley of New York, where the mall in Kingston, New York, the big mall in Kingston, New York, just on the north end as you're heading out of Kingston, is losing all of its major anchor stores, and they've got ownership, new ownership. And the new ownership wants to bring back, that's what they're trying to look. They're trying to find a way to fill those spaces with local merchants. To replace those huge stores in different ways to get people to once again not only come back to the mall but to shop. It's a very interesting problem that I think towns and the mall owners themselves and the retailers have got to ponder.
Right. Now, this is not a big mall. You know, this is about 10 stores. Is it that many, David?
I don't know. I just find it, it makes it very difficult for people who, like myself, who live here and have kids. For instance, one of the stores it's not just, you know, the Kmart that went out of business or left. It's places like Olympia Sports, where you could buy, soccer shoes and uniforms for kids playing sports. I mean, now you have to go, as Marcy mentioned, you have to go, 45 minutes away in order to get that stuff. Or lunch boxes. How about that? You know?
Yeah.
Simple things that
air mattresses.
Or air mattresses. I mean,
or a soccer ball. It's fine to shop online if you have 2 or 3 days to wait for it to be delivered, but when you need something quickly, so I'm a big advocate of shopping local, and the Edge has been a big advocate. We did a Thanksgiving promotion to try to get people into the stores,
one of the problems I see here is that this little shopping center was filled with the stores were not locally owned. You know, these are chains. And so their calculation and their calculus for where they are, it has nothing to do with the local people at all.
But one of the great things about that shopping center is you have an anchor like now Marshall's, right? And you also have a food anchor, okay?
We have the Price Chopper.
So you have two large draws. This is what I think mall owners have to do. They have to figure out now how do you incorporate the local merchants, make the rents reasonable enough where local merchants can also put in stores there or even start businesses there.
Right. Well, I think there's only one local store in that place, and that's the Book Loft.
Yep.
Right.
Which is a bookstore. And that's been there.
Yeah. Well, so we have a mattress place, and we have in that mall, there's a mattress place.
And a dollar store, which
may be locally owned, but it's a local franchise.
Yeah.
And a dollar store, and a Verizon store. What else? I mean, so David's right. Anyway. They're not locally owned, and then but they do provide a local service.
Yeah, but it's a little different. So it's going to be interesting how the whole story is well, what are the new owners going to do to make the shopping plaza more vibrant?
Right.
Plain and simple.
Right. And also, how are we going to keep downtown Great Barrington vibrant as well? Because we've lost a couple of stores there. Including one clothing store that sold children's clothes and shoes. So,
yep.
I mean, the people who have lived in Great Barrington for, 30 or 40 years talk about what it used to be like in the old days, where you could buy everything locally. But, of course, now, the local stores have become more expensive and are looking more to visitors and tourists. In some cases, than they are to locals. So the locals really have no place to get what they need. People who are, who are maintaining full lives in Great Barrington.
All right, I want to go on to your next story because it's I think and Great Barrington is really starting to capitalize on the life and the death and the legacy of W.E.B. Du Bois and now making plans. To celebrate the 150th anniversary of his birth.
That's right. Yeah. It starts, actually, they've been, Du Bois has been vilified, actually, over the years in Great Barrington because he, late in life, he disavowed America because of its treatment of blacks, and he left. But he left quite a legacy of writing that is, and he helped found the NAACP, and he was just a real intellectual powerhouse, a Harvard graduate and a graduate of Searles High School in Great Barrington. the town has sort of had a change of heart in a way. And they're going to celebrate, have a almost a month-long celebration of his legacy in the Great Barrington, starting on Martin Luther King Day, Monday, January 15th, and then concluding on February 23rd, Du Bois' birthday. So there's going to be talks and lectures and banners across Main Street, and there's even a local group that is campaigning to have a statue of him erected in a public place downtown. So that's all good.
it's all the more interesting in the context of earlier efforts to celebrate Du Bois as really Great Barrington's most famous son. When he was young and going to high school in Great Barrington, there were a group of local businessmen who realized his talent, and they got together and raised the money to send him to college. I mean, I think he first went to, where did he go first, David? He went to one of the historically black colleges, and then he transferred to Harvard. And he was supported by the town. But then later in life, when he became really disillusioned with the progress that his people were making, he turned toward communism. And at the very end of his life, he he moved to, oh, I forget where, but, you know, to an African country where he died and is buried. So earlier attempts to establish a national landmark or national monument to his death, or to his birthplace, rather, and also even as recently as, you know, in the 1990s, early 2000s, when we built two new schools, there was an effort to name one of the schools after him, and that was voted down. So, you know, it's been a difficult route to recognize Du Bois, who, as David said, was the founder of the NAACP and was one of the most eloquent and literary leaders of the civil rights movement in the 20th century.
It's amazing. Yep. It's amazing what time does to one's legacy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it's true. Right.
The longer you have to look at someone's legacy and what they did, and then compare it to the legacy that you're now living yourself, it's pretty amazing how it tends to change sometimes dramatically.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Well, times change. Right.
All right, we will go on to your next article, and this one affects not only you folks in Berkshire County, but I know it raises our eyebrows here because we're a nonprofit.
Right.
And your article describes the reaction among nonprofits in Berkshire County about the new tax bill, which really takes the incentive to donate, it seems, away from not mega-rich people, but most of the ordinary people below that.
Right. Well, I think everybody... Right. Yeah, go ahead, David. Sorry.
Go ahead, Marcy. No.
Well, you know, I think... the story is that, of course, the tax bill is now giving everybody a higher standard deduction, and nonprofits are concerned that without tax deductions, people won't donate at the level that they were before. I mean, and that really is the people, sort of middle class people, who itemize, and now there'll be a disincentive for them to itemize because they'll have a $12,000 automatic deduction. And I think the big question is, for me at any rate, do people give because they get a tax deduction, or do they give because it's the right thing to do?
I think what we found here is we don't have a huge donor base, but I'll tell you 90% of the people that donate to us give because they believe in something that we do, not that they're going to put it on their taxes. That's the truth. I mean, that $30,000 that we raised, there wasn't one person who.
But
for our regular
donors, many of whom you would be surprised. The more helpful are people who have the least give the most, and and they do use it as a tax deduction, but they won't stop giving.
Well, I hope not.
There's something else here, and I think it's more of a symbolic gesture, is that the tax, before Trump and his Republican gang got hold of this, there was an incentive to be generous built into the tax code. It wasn't that, you know, you wouldn't give if you didn't get the deduction, but that the tax code itself recognized and encouraged by implicitly,
right,
the donations to nonprofits, and that's gone away. And I think that to me is more important over the long haul than whether you can, you know, next year take, you know, a few hundred dollars off your tax bill. It's the symbolic gesture of recognizing and encouraging charitable charity that is now been taken away.
Here's the thought process. Here's the thought process that has been the mega change. It used to be when you tax the rich more, a higher tax rate, that was the incentive for the rich
To give more,
and to do more with their businesses because they could take it off their taxes.
But as the mega rich became mega, mega rich, different people started doing different things, i.e. wings of hospitals. I mean, moving it down to the smaller nonprofits, and that becomes a question.
It's going to be interesting to see what happened.
I think, you know, one of the things that Jill is talking about, too, that sort of always upsets me is that the trend toward philanthropy has become, you know, very self-congratulatory.
Yeah.
I mean, that instead of being, you know, as one would hope, you know, fairly anonymous or community-minded, but now wealthy, you're right, they put wings of hospitals, they pay for rooms at the Metropolitan Museum or galleries, so that their names are on things, and it's no longer, you know, becomes a form of advertiser, self-promotion, more than philanthropy, which is, you know, which I find disturbing.
All right, I want to go on because we're only going to get through four or five of these stories, but is a great story.
Return to philanthropy, however.
This next story on the letters, drawings, and photos of thanks from Berkshire Country Day School from the different families in Puerto Rico who received aid from the school's drive.
Oh, yeah. Well, the school, Berkshire Country Day, was organized because one of the teachers herself is from Puerto Rico, and she helped organize a rather, school-wide, and this included staff, teachers, students, and parents to get together aid for the hurricane-ravaged island. So they did, and they they supported 78 families, and they sent off these care packages, which included all kinds of goods for them, and they packed them up and sent them off, and then they were flooded with thanks from the families themselves and their relatives. And in fact, we even got, when we posted this on our site, we even got some thanks from Puerto Ricans for running the article. It was quite amazing, actually. Of course, you have to remember, you know, Puerto Rico is part of the United States.
Right.
They are American citizens.
Well,
75%.
So this is not. Listen, this is. I think a lot better gesture than throwing paper towels at them. Don't you think?
I would think so. Absolutely. All right. Let's move on to Carol Owens and her column. Now, this is interesting. You know, we've all heard, "What would Jesus do? What would George Washington do?"
Right. Well, Carol, who writes a weekly column for us, says, often very interesting. We talked last week about, you know, her article about the scams that had been run in Berkshire County. Apparently George Washington wrote a book. I mean, he copied a book. I mean, he transcribed Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation when he was 16 years old, and he transcribed them, I think, from something that the Jesuits had put out. And there's question as to whether these were rules that he really wanted to live by or whether it was a penmanship assignment. But nevertheless, I mean, he did write out these rules of civility. And, you know, the first rule was every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present. And there are 110 rules. Some are odd, but they're saying, you know, show nothing to your friend that might affright him. In other words, don't scare your friends with odd or unacceptable behavior. Be no flatterer, neither play with any that delights not to be played with. In other words, don't flirt with somebody who does not wish to be flirted with. These are lovely rules for showing respect for, you know, your companions and your society. And she's, of course, contrasting it with the kinds of things that are being said in public these days.
I can't wait for her.
You know.
Huh? I was going to say, I can't wait for her article, George Washington on Twitter. Or basically social media and how that helps with respect.
Yeah, I know, right. Yeah, well, I'm going to encourage, maybe George Washington had a comment that is, but you know, it does underscore the lack of, the state of lack of civility that we've unfortunately come to in this country.
All right, well.
Where, anyway, we don't have
we
to
only
go
have about
over
2 minutes.
Again.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and we have to mention your next story where you'll get commentary about Oprah Winfrey's being touted as a presidential candidate, and this is where I drop the mic. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
As opposed to a mic drop.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Leonard Quart, who writes regularly for us and teaches film at NYU, wrote a review about the Golden Globes Awards ceremony, you know, where Oprah gave a spectacular speech, and immediately all over Facebook and Twitter there were comments, you know, Oprah for president. And, you know, she is an accomplished woman. She's a successful businesswoman. She's a great speaker. But, you know, we've had one of these already. We have one now. And the question is, what are the criteria for running for president? Do you just have to be rich and famous, or do you actually have to have some policy and government experience?
You have to be popular on Twitter. Come on.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, we did have, you may remember, Marcy, that Ronald Reagan was an actor and he was a TV personality, and then he was governor of California.
But he at least was governor of California. He had some government experience.
He had something going for him. And when you compare Ronald Reagan to the current crop of people that either are president or want to be president, you long for the days, believe it or not, of Ronald Reagan.
And if you're as old as I am, you remember certain horrified people, absolutely horrified at the notion of Ronald Reagan for president.
Well, anyways, we are out of time.
Well, I remember that. Well, listen, I was in California when he was governor, and one of his most famous statements was that in support of chopping down the redwood trees in Northern California, he said, "Well, you've seen one redwood tree; you've seen them all."
So
that sums up his environmental policy.
That would have made a great tweet nowadays.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, it would.
Well done. 140 characters, right?
We are out of time.
Okay. Well, thank you. Talk to you next week.
Right,
always a
care,
pleasure.
Guys.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That is This Week in the Berkshire Edge here on Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com.